Earlier this month, Iran unveiled another homegrown vaccine dubbed Covfars, which is now undergoing the first phase of the human trials. Administered through injection and inhalation, Covfars is an mRNA recombinant vaccine that reconstructs a harmless piece of the virus's spike protein. The second batch of Russia's Sputnik V arrived in Iran last week amid an ongoing voluntary vaccination in the country. Iran's government says it does not favor Iranian vaccines over foreign counterparts, and the priority is to start the nationwide vaccination campaign as soon as possible.
Now that the Coviran vaccine has proved safe for mass vaccination, the next step is to test its efficacy. Experts say this will be made clear in the second phase of the human trial, which will kickstart in almost a month. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Palestinian refugees in the blockaded Gaza Strip demonstrated in front of UNRWA aid distribution centers against cuts to vital services and assistance by the UN agency. UNRWA provides education, health, and welfare services to millions of Palestinian refugees in the occupied West Bank, Jerusalem, Al-Quds, the Gaza Strip, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. As of Sunday, UNRWA implemented further aid cuts to Palestinian refugees, citing budget deficit, but Palestinians maintain that cuts are merely political.
These cuts are purely political and have nothing to do with a budget deficit. Palestinian refugees will continue to fight these conspiracies against the Palestinians and their rights until we achieve the right of return. UNRWA must stop these measures that aim to undermine the issue of refugees and the Palestinian cause.
The Israeli regime has been campaigning to defund the UN agency in an attempt to end the refugees' right of return. The crisis deepened after former US President Donald Trump decided to cancel funding to UNRWA in 2018.
UNRWA has been cutting back its services over the years. What they gave us today is not enough to feed our families. Every time we get less food items. Today they gave me a small bag of sugar, which is barely enough to make tea for a few days. We are extremely poor and we want UNRWA to restore all of our food aid in order for us to survive.
The vast majority of Gazans are refugees who were kicked out of their towns and villages upon the establishment of the Israeli regime in 1948. Palestinian refugees who suffered for more than seven decades say UNRWA cuts will only increase their plight amid the coronavirus pandemic.
The cuts come at a time that Palestinian refugees are suffering the worst humanitarian conditions because of the COVID-19 pandemic. UNRWA must increase aid instead of cutting it. Palestinian refugees in the Gaza Strip are extremely poor and are the worst hit by these cuts.
Over 1.3 million Palestinian refugees live in the Gaza Strip, and their hardships have increased under the Israeli blockade.
Palestinian refugees say that as long as they are displaced and dispossessed, UNRWA should provide them with all due services without any cuts. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Palestinians in the Gaza Strip held a press conference aimed at expressing the refusal of the recent normalization of ties with Israeli regime. The conference comes as a code of ethics for Palestinian journalists and media institutes to stress their rejection for normalizing ties with Israel.
We condemn the recent normalization of ties with Israel. We held this conference as a code of ethics for journalists and media institutes to reveal the Israeli violations and normalization of ties with the Israeli regime. The normalization of ties remains a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause.
A number of Palestinian leaders, activists, and journalists attended the conference and condemned establishing Israeli relations, stressing that no deal can bring peace to Israel in the West Asia. Palestinian journalists and activists added that media has a significant role in conveying the true image of the inhumane Israeli regime and refused any normalization of ties with Israel in terms of media.
Normalizing ties with Israel is a way to justify the inhumane nature of Israel. The recent normalization of ties with Israel is a betrayal of the Palestinian cause. and we won't accept any recognition of Israel at the expense of Palestinians.
Palestinians call on Arab and Muslim nations to end this normalization of ties with Israel that aims to demolish the historical Palestinian cause.
Palestinian activists are all united to say that normalization of ties with Israel is a betrayal of all Palestinians. Media should stand against these attempts to demolish the Palestinian cause. All Arabs and Muslims should stop recognizing Israel as a state.
So far, a number of Arab states have normalized their ties with Israel, including the United Arab Emirates and Bahrain. The move has sparked harsh criticism among the Muslim nations. Palestinians here stress they strongly refuse to recognize Israel and reject the normalization of ties with the Tel Aviv regime by certain countries. They say the resistance is ongoing and no deal can bring peace to Israel at the expense of Palestinians. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
The average student in the United States today leaves college with $37,000 of debt from student loans. University tuition has risen 1,200% since the late 1970s. Those younger than 24, called Generation Z, face the same prospect of expensive higher education combined with national economic stagnation since 2008. While on the campaign trail, Democrats raised major hopes with talk of an executive order canceling up to $50,000 in student debt. But President Joe Biden just declared, quote, "I will not make that happen," and he will only consider $10,000 in debt relief.
Student debt is parasitic. It's very right-wing. Joe Biden isn't centrist. He's right-wing. He's always been right-wing. If this person said that he had the capability to do it, which he does, and he said he does, and he's not going to do it because it sets the wrong precedent, then you're going to have a bunch of angry people.
Such huge amounts of debt has forced the millennial class to often delay mature steps, like buying a house, investing, pursuing a graduate degree, marriage, and children. That all depresses the economy, creates more social instability and disharmony, and all the while, economic inequality skyrockets in favor of the moneylenders.
I have $28K in student debt. Under capitalism, like, college can be a very predatory thing. You're betting the rest of your life to, like, being able to make these payments. And this is going to create more distrust for the Democrats. This is going to embolden more people that might be Republican that also have a lot of student debt to not trust this person.
The student debt crisis is seemingly a uniquely American issue, but 45 million Americans owe almost $2 trillion in student debt. The immense scope of the problem seems to ensure that the nation's young adults will keep this issue in the limelight for years, or maybe even decades, until either debt relief is granted or wages massively rise. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
The scramble for vaccines has exposed global inequality yet again. Rich economies, including the US, EU, and the UK, have collectively secured more than double the amount they need, 3 billion doses, and administered 75% of the vaccines actually in existence. But in dozens of countries, no one has been vaccinated.
We are more than a little bit concerned that there is or is to be hoarding and price gouging, as well as undue preference in some quarters. This being so, we at CARICOM have recently called upon WHO to immediately convene an international convention of the world's people's representatives to commiserate, explain, assist, and commit to a fair sharing of the available vaccine resources for the benefit of all humankind and not just the privileged, well-heeled few.
Accused of hoarding, world leaders at the G7 summit Friday tried to stave off criticism by making more pledges. The UK has boasted about leading the world out of the pandemic, but Boris Johnson says the UK comes first, and spare doses will only be given away once all British adults have got the jab. The projection for that is July. US President Joe Biden also used the G7 summit, his first international meeting, to redeem Washington's reputation as the largest contributor to organizations like the World Health Organization. Geopolitics is at play here. Russia and China have emerged as major vaccine suppliers, but the EU has been accused of failing to execute a fair and even rollout, forcing nations to look elsewhere for supplies. China and Russia have already shipped tens of thousands of doses of their COVID-19 vaccine to developing and underdeveloped countries as well. Meanwhile, the US has stopped short of donating from its own massive supply. Amnesty International says rich countries do themselves no favors by hoarding. In the end, if not enough people are immunized, the virus will have free range to mutate and outsmart the vaccines. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Israeli forces opened the gates of its rainwater stores east of Gaza, allowing rainwater to flood large swaths of Palestinian land. The Palestinian Ministry of Agriculture said in a statement that the water drowned thousands of meters of agricultural lands and damaged wheat and other winter crops. This led to great financial losses for farmers.
Every year in this time, Israeli army opens the rainwater gates to flood our lands and destroy the crops. Israel also sprays harmful herbicides at our land, damaging all the farms and crops planted. These attempts aim at forcing us to leave this land. We stress that these attempts won't make us leave. We will remain here.
In violation of international standards, Israeli army also shoot at Palestinian farmers to push them off their lands and spray herbicides beside the buffer zone along the Gaza Strip, something directly affects the livelihood of Palestinians.
This is the second time in a month the Israeli army has opened its water gates and flooded our agricultural lands. All the winter crops are now destroyed here. This means a great financial loss for the farmers and even consumers. Our life as a farmer is under risk of being shot by Israeli army.
The Ministry of Agriculture says the move hampers transference of Gaza's main source of fruits and vegetables.
Over thousands of meters of our lands have been destroyed this time. Opening rainwater gates is a move by Israeli army to force us to leave our lands and damage the main food supply for Gaza. Drowning these crops would not only damage the planted crops, but also the lands.
Palestinians here say the living conditions have been deteriorating due to the Israeli blockade. They say Israel is now making the bad situation worse by damaging their agricultural lands and causing them financial losses. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
In the Rohingya refugee camp in the outskirts of New Delhi, there is an utter panic, and the residents are fearful even going out to buy the essentials. They say many are chased, intimidated, and usually police and other agencies visit their camps to monitor their movements. Ali Johar, a young Rohingya refugee, says several have been arrested in the recent months and put into jails for illegally entering India, saying the whole community is in utter despair.
Around 60 people have been arrested in the different parts of India, including West Bengal, Manipur, Assam, Haryana, and Delhi. In Delhi, around 8 people were detained. In Haryana, several families were harassed to leave out from Haryana.
Fearful of possible arrest and expulsion, scores of refugees have gone into hiding across the Indian subcontinent, while others have entered Bangladesh amid a mounting hate campaign against the community in India. The destitute community, who has escaped what the United Nations described genocide, is struggling for existence amid international silence about their plight. An estimated 40,000 are living in India. The community has faced a brutal crackdown by the army in their country, such as rape, murder, child killings, arbitrary arrests, forced disappearances, as well as destruction of the entire Rohingya villages. Now many fear that the military coup might make the situation even worse. Some reports suggest hundreds of Rohingya are being held in Indian jails on charges of illegal entry and have no proper judicial support. Their men are unable to find work due to lack of identity cards and threats of intimidation by law enforcement agencies, forcing men to stay at their camps.
We have been living here peacefully since 2012. We came to save our lives, but the police and other agencies are usually coming to our camps for questioning, asking our IDs, and this has become a routine. We are terrified and we can't even sleep, thinking what would happen to us.
Anti-Rohingya sentiments have risen since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government of BJP in 2014. Since then, many anti-Rohingya campaigns and Hindu groups have been demanding their expulsion, while the government describes them as a security threat. Observers say the Rohingya refugees in particular have in the past and present been used largely for political reasons in this part of the world. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
Yemenis have come together before the UN office in Sana'a to call on the international community to step in under pressure the Saudi-led coalition into releasing detained oil vessels. The detention of oil vessels has left the country in desperate struggle to survive amid a harsh shortage of fuel.
We have lots of problems amid fuel shortage. We stay here for days to get some liters of gasoline due to the blockade imposed by the Saudi-led coalition and the continued detention of oil ships. We call on those who are after making concessions against the enemies to stand firm when it comes to the basic needs of Yemeni people.
Major sectors, including health, have warned that they may collapse in a few days if the detained oil vessels by the Saudi-led coalition are not immediately released. Thousands of facilities have already stopped providing services due to a lack of fuel.
The situation today is entirely catastrophic, especially in the health sector. The petroleum company is unable to provide health facilities with the oil derivatives. 50 days have passed and not even a liter has been allowed to enter the port of Hodeidah. The U.S. and the U.N. bear responsibility of what is happening in Yemen.
The Saudi-led coalition is still holding 14 Yemeni oil ships illegally as they were inspected and authorized by the United Nations through verification and inspection mechanism. Hundreds of cars take days in long lines in front of the only working gas station in Sana'a. Yemenis say overcoming this dire situation needs a real action by the international community to step in and to pressure the Saudi-led coalition to release the detained oil vessels. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
The prosecutor's office against hate crimes in Barcelona says it sees sufficient evidence to investigate Spain's far right for allegedly inciting hatred against Muslims following a complaint by several Muslim communities in Catalonia. At the core of the controversy is a video published online by the nativist ultra-nationalist party Vox during the recent election campaign in Catalonia.
The video falsely claims the entire Muslim community in Catalonia is responsible for the 2017 terrorist attacks in Barcelona. It purportedly shows footage of women in burqas in mosques that was actually shot in Afghanistan and other countries.
Vox's Twitter account was temporarily suspended at the end of January for breaching the company's hate speech regulations with false accusations and unfounded claims against Muslims in Catalonia.
Their strategy is to polarize society, to create fear and manipulate that fear in order to antagonize communities. This is an old mechanism that underlines all forms of racism. It alienates others by labeling them as foreigners. It goes back centuries in the Iberian Peninsula, and that is where you need to start in order to understand the rise of Islamophobia in Spain.
Vox won 11 seats in Catalonia's regional parliament. Their aggressive campaign against Muslims has raised awareness among community leaders to re-examine their alliances.
We regret the silence of political parties in Catalonia in this election. While they all wooed Muslim voters, not a single one had the courage to stand up and denounce the Islamophobic, xenophobic attacks against our country.
Although Catalonia is home to nearly 500,000 Muslims and has elected its first Muslim female member of parliament in 2017, it does not have a central cultural center or great mosque to this day.
Unlike in previous suits against the far right, representatives of the Muslim community in Catalonia say they believe they have a solid case against Vox. They trust the courts will do them justice this time around. Kusai Kedri, Barcelona.
The bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
The COVID-19 pandemic has had a profound effect on those living with obsessive compulsive disorder or OCD. Whilst large-scale studies are hard to come by, smaller data sets from Europe show between a third and half of those suffering from obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, had symptoms worsen during the coronavirus pandemic. This can be especially problematic for people whose OCD was already focused on cleanliness. We now present you an article authored by Matilda Bosley. The piece is titled, How COVID is a Double-Edged Sword for Those with OCD. The article has been taken from the British newspaper The Guardian. Please stay with us for more of Matilda Bosley's article. Luca Buchanan has always been consumed by the fear of contamination and germs, washing their hands until they were raw and terrified the food they ate would poison them. Diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder or OCD at the age of 19, Buchanan, who uses they or them pronouns, spent years in therapy telling themselves over and over that there was nothing to fear, that the chances of a global contagion were minuscule, and that they weren't infected and dangerous to those around them. Buchanan says, I have to tell myself over and over there's no justification for the levels of compulsions that I'm having about cleanliness. Then last March, Luca Buchanan's worst fears came true. Suddenly, it's like, oh yeah, I was right. The COVID-19 pandemic has had a profound effect on those living with obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. While large-scale studies are hard to come by, smaller data sets from Europe show between a third and half of those suffering from obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, had symptoms worsen during the coronavirus pandemic. This can especially be problematic for people like Buchanan, whose OCD was already focused on cleanliness. The Perth, Australian native says, I could physically feel the germs on me, but then I kind of wasn't really able to rationalize it, because at that point we didn't know much about the virus. He added, obsessive compulsive disorder loves doubt and uncertainty, and because there was a lot of uncertainty, it really did trigger me in a big way. Thank you. Dr. James Collett, a psychologist at the Royal Melbourne Institute of Technology, says although it was necessary from a public health standpoint, much of the government messaging around COVID-19 has been problematic for those with obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. Dr. James Collett says the obsessions don't occur at random, they're connected to the person's worries, adding, the COVID messaging is saying that, yeah, there are germs out there, and yeah, you might hurt someone severely by spreading germs without even knowing it. People are really internalizing this, even saying it's cementing their OCD. And for clinicians, these messages have been difficult to combat. Dr. James Collett says, a client with obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, saying, I was right all along, well, that's actually pretty hard to argue with right now. Adding, for clients that were previously experiencing washing-type symptoms, we're seeing reduced social interaction and greater interpersonal conflicts as well. But this fear hasn't been universal. For Luca Buchanan's friend, Kai, the pandemic has had the opposite effect. Kai, who asked for his last name not to be included, says, I've had obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, pretty much my entire life, and as a result, I've always felt a lot of shame about it because of my behavior. Kai's OCD is also focused on germs and cleanliness. He always carries hand sanitizers. He washes his hands before every meal, and whenever possible, he likes to keep a safe distance between himself and other people and their possible germs. He laughs. Those are now just standard practices that everybody does, adding, it's made it a lot easier to go out and have a social life because people don't automatically notice that I have this mental illness. That takes a lot of the shame away. Kai says in the first days of the coronavirus pandemic, he was terrified that the global panic would make his anxiety and compulsions even worse, but this never came to pass. He says, the world hasn't felt any more scary than it did before. The level of anxiety that a lot of people who don't have obsessive compulsive disorder are now feeling about getting sick, that's just the way my brain works all the time. He added, a lot of us in online OCD support groups have been joking about how we have been preparing for this all of our lives. But Dr. James Collett says the increased awareness about cleanliness and staying at home may make it more difficult to identify people who are struggling with undiagnosed obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. He says, because of COVID-19, we may need to actually raise the threshold of the OCD diagnosis, adding, in the past, if someone was washing their hands every time they touched something in public or something like that, we might say, oh, that's a bit of a worry, maybe vulnerable to OCD. Now we might actually be saying, oh yeah, that's normal, understandable behavior. Dr. James Collett continues, we might actually find that where our ability to detect those OCD symptoms is actually a bit off in terms of just differentiating it from normal, healthy behavior now. For both Kai and Luca Buchanan, this newfound permission to take cleanliness seriously is a double-edged sword. Luca Buchanan has worked for years to reduce the number of times they wash their hands each day. Now there is a sign in every shop reminding them to wash again. They say, I have to be really strict to only wash my hands for those 20 seconds, adding, if you could think of it like an addiction, there's no such thing as having a little bit of it because it just unlocks the gates. It feels so good to use those compulsions to quell the anxiety. I just struggle with what is actually too much. Before the coronavirus pandemic, one of Kai's main goals was to press the pedestrian button on street corners with his hands. He says, as I was starting to get to a point where I could do that, the rules changed, and now the ones in Perth have stickers on them saying, bump with your elbow, which is what I was doing before, adding, I'm back to square one. The more years I've reinforced the behavior, the harder it is to undo it. They become cemented in your brain. Attention is now turning to how to help those with obsessive-compulsive disorder transition out of the pandemic state of mind once vaccines become widespread. Dr. James Collett says there's a real worry about people having difficulty unlearning these behaviors that are appropriate during COVID pandemic. He says this easing period may be the most crucial in identifying people who may have been suffering from unnoticed dysfunctional behaviors throughout the pandemic. He says, I think the real message is we need to reach out to people who were perhaps seeming a bit more withdrawn, or they're still really invested in things that are starting to look like ritual patterns of behavior. Despite the increased anxiety, Luca Buchanan has found a lot of comfort in society's new obsession with hygiene. Buchanan says, I love the fact that I would go into a restaurant and they would have plexiglass things in front of the counter. Suddenly, everyone's sitting 1.5 meters apart in public transport. Oh God, that's my dream. But they know this won't last forever. They said, I really hope this hygienic awareness just remains as like a post-COVID world, adding, but I'll live with obsessive-compulsive disorder for the rest of my life, so the world is going to keep changing, and I'll just have to try and make it work, I guess.
The debate.
If you thought white supremacists was a U.S. problem, think again. According to the UN, white supremacists and neo-Nazis are becoming a transnational threat. Why would this elevate to a threat level at this point? Another key question, how have the groups taken advantage of the pandemic to boost their support? That's what the UN has said. Just some of the questions we will be asking our guests in this edition of the debate.
The UN Secretary General says white supremacy and the rise of neo-Nazi groups are becoming a transnational threat, warning that the coronavirus pandemic is not helping things. Antonio Guterres told the UN Human Rights Council that risk amounts to terrorism.
We must also step up the fight against resurgent neo-Nazism, white supremacy, and racially and ethnically motivated terrorism. The danger of these hate-driven movements is growing by the day. Let us call them what they are. White supremacy and neo-Nazi movements are more than domestic terror threats. They are becoming a transnational threat. These and other groups have exploited the pandemic to boost their ranks through social polarization and political and cultural manipulation.
Guterres did not name any states, but he warned that groups preaching hate are now a number one internal security threat for several countries. The U.S. has been under the spotlight for racially motivated tensions over the past years, more than any other country. Racial tensions simmered under the presidency of Donald Trump, with some months-long protests triggered by the murder of unarmed African-American George Floyd in the hands of white police officers in 2020. Many described it as the most serious social unrest in the U.S. since the civil rights movement of the 1960s. But at least for U.S. officials, nothing was as serious as the siege of the Capitol Hill building, but what incumbent President Joe Biden called thugs, insurrectionists, political extremists, and white supremacists. Guterres hinted at the incident when he warned of hate groups being cheered by people in position of responsibility. Trump openly slammed anti-fascist protests against right-wing extremism amid cheers by white supremacists. But he's not the only Western leader to have attempted to bring back pro-racism rhetoric to center stage. Far-right political parties are now a new reality of politics across Europe. The continent has also been struck by neo-Nazi protests. Far-right politics and protests have been taking different forms, with Britain, France, Germany, Italy, and the Netherlands being some of the hotbeds recently. But a few commonalities tie them all together. They attempt to revive toxic notions of white superiority by stoking fear of religious, ethnic, and racial minorities with a focus on Islam, immigrants, and non-whites. That's sugar-coated with models of defense against threats encroaching on what they tend to call accepted Western values. In May 2019, Italian Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini led a rally of his European far-right allies in Milan. There, he vowed to remold Europe by crackdown on immigrants while protecting the perceived European civilization. That was foreshadowed by international gatherings of neo-Nazi groups in Germany, Poland, and the US. Guterres now warns that this is leading to a growing network of hateful ideologies.
Individuals and groups are engaged in a feeding frenzy of hate, fundraising, recruiting, and communicating online, both at home and overseas, traveling internationally to train together and network their hateful ideologies.
The rise of far-right has led to a surge in attacks on minorities in Western countries, including Britain, France, Germany, and the US, where authorities have been reporting hundreds of racially charged attacks on Muslims and mosques for over the past years. During the coronavirus pandemic, such incidents have also taken the new shape of certain restrictions on minorities' access to medical care and vaccines. Warnings like the one from the UN chief have been there for some time, but a problem lingers on in the absence of meaningful action from Western governments.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the debate, editor at Culture Wars online magazine, E. Michael Jones, joins us from South Bend, Indiana. We also have author and broadcaster Jonathan Fryer, who joins us from London. Gentlemen, welcome. If I may first start with you, E. Michael Jones, and ask your reaction about what the UN has said. Well, what the UN has warned us about, that white supremacists and neo-Nazi groups are becoming a transnational threat. Tell us how that has happened, in your opinion, and why has it become a threat now, not before?
Let me begin by saying that in all the years that I've been contributing to Press TV, this has got to be one of the dumbest, most preposterous statements I have ever heard in my life, okay? This is a complete fabrication on the part of the oligarchs to demonize a group of people who are simply trying to stay alive and survive under really horrible conditions. I'm talking about the United States of America. Okay, I'm going to go one step further, and I'm going to say there are no white people in the United States of America. White is a political category that is based on certain characteristics that gets imposed on groups of people for political purposes to demonize them. That's what's going on here. It's that simple. There's no threat in the United States, and there's certainly no international threat. This is pure oligarch speech.
So, pure oligarch speech there, Jonathan Fryer, is what our guest there is saying. And also, if I understood him correctly, he has blasted the statement coming from the UN. In particular, it came from the UN Secretary General that is calling, or is making the statement, white supremacists, in reference perhaps to the U.S. here. Is E. Michael Jones there justified in his anger, I should say?
Well, I listened with great interest to what Michael had to say, but I disagree completely. I think that the UN Secretary General was quite correct. There really is a problem, not only in North America, but also here in Europe. Indeed, European intelligence agencies, including the British MI5, the Internal Intelligence Agency, have stepped up its monitoring of far-right white extremist groups and individuals ahead of the previously the attention focused mainly on Islamist extremists. And there really is a problem, and this has got worse during the COVID pandemic. We saw it with the Proud Boys who marched with others on the Capitol Hill last month in Washington. We've seen it here in Britain and in other European countries. And several far-right politicians have taken advantage of the proportional representation in countries like the Netherlands to win seats in the parliament of the different countries. And indeed, Marine Le Pen, the head of the right-wing group, which is overtly anti-Islamic, is highly likely to win at least the first round of the presidential election, though she may be defeated in the second round, thanks to the French political system.
Mm-hmm. Well, E. Michael Jones, The anger that you expressed on what the UN Secretary General has said somewhat parallels what the U.S. President Joe Biden said recently, that white supremacists are the greatest domestic terror threat in the U.S., and calling, and let me just read off, calling what people who support them or their ideals demented and dangerous. I'm guessing you don't agree with Joe Biden, do you?
No. The Secretary of the UN got it from Joe Biden. It's obvious. This is the oligarch narrative. Okay, I have a question for my colleague in London. Okay, is Mr. Salvini white?
He would self-identify as white, and I, unfortunately, many of the supporters of the Liga in Italy are supporters of white supremacy. And although the white European might be a broad definition ethnically, it's what people identify as. And in America, there's a group, not just the Proud Boys, other groups who have targeted non-white immigrants, particularly coming from Central America and Mexico, and also Islamic groups. Here in Europe, it's more the Islamic minorities in countries like France and the Netherlands, but they self-identify as white, and quite rightly say there was an awful lot of...
Is he in it?
On Twitter. White Lives Matter. We matter.
Okay, go ahead. Michael Jones.
Yeah, there was an article in the New York Times when the Italians became white. Okay, there was a time here in America when Italians were not white. Okay. Now we have a situation where this category of white is being imposed on anybody that the government doesn't like. Okay, so I was involved in this situation here this summer. St. Louis, there's a statue. Everybody's tearing down statues this summer, and there's a statue of St. Louis, the patron of the city. Okay, this statue has to come down. Well, why? I mean, it's not Robert E. Lee. What's going on here? Is St. Louis white? So the man who's orchestrating this campaign says it's white supremacists who are defending the statue of St. Louis. Well, you look into the story, and it turns out those white supremacists are praying the rosary. Is this something that white supremacists do? No, it's something the Catholics do. And so what we're seeing here, the classic example of what I'm talking about, this is identity theft. Anytime you use the word white, you are engaging in identity theft. And so the whole narrative here is, as soon as you identify a group as white, they've lost the battle. Because as soon as you're white, you're racist. And as soon as you're racist, you have no rights. So I entered into this discussion, wrote an article on it. Within hours of posting the article on the internet, this guy, Umar Lee, challenges me to a debate in which I changed the narrative. So it's not a battle between white supremacists and black people. It's a battle between Catholics and Jews. Because the Jews are the only people who are concerned about King Louis of France, because he burned the Talmud. This is a type of misdirection that is being orchestrated by the people who run the show now in the United States, and now the idiots who are in charge of the United Nations are too stupid to understand what's going on.
I think we got six topics out of what statements there that Michael Jones just made. I'm trying to break that down in my head. I have a tough time wrapping my head around some of the things that you said, E. Michael Jones. I'm going to come back to you, though, because I'm going to give the floor now to Jonathan Fryer. Jonathan Fryer, there's a map that has about 20 countries in Europe that have nationalist parties that came into power just very recently. You can talk about, well, gosh, that covers quite a number of countries, Italy, France, Spain, you name it. Why have white nationalists actually struck such a chord with the population itself, at large, I should say, for them to come into power and hold political posts?
Well, because essentially they've been talking to grievances among a certain proportion of white people. But I think we need to make the distinction between white people and white supremacists. Although white supremacists are white as they see it, they are nonetheless very different from the majority of white people who have embraced the multiculturalism of the European and indeed European Union and of the United Kingdom. But what we've seen right across Europe, from Hungary through to Spain and Portugal, is the recent arrival of strong minority opinion amongst white disenfranchised people who feel that they have grievances against the state, either the state is handling the COVID epidemic badly, or that they ought to get the virus protection, the vaccine, before the white minority, before the minority communities. And we're seeing a very difficult situation here in Europe. As I say, it's definitely happening. It's not a figment of imagination of Antonio Guterres, and it's not even something that's coming originate from the United States, I don't believe. I really think there is a problem here in Europe that's been developing over several years, long before the pandemic began, and which is largely because of the large influx of Islamic migrants to Hungary and Poland and other parts of Europe who came from Syria in particular. And although Germany opened its doors and welcomed, the right-wing groups in other countries, on the contrary, have been very antagonistic to these new arrivals. And we've seen within the Mediterranean countries, Italy, Spain, and so on, a backlash against these new arrivals, and the backlash against Islam. I don't agree at all with Michael, who said that this is a Christian or Catholic versus Jews. This is more Christian civilization versus Islamic civilization. For those of Britain, majority, it's not a problem. But for white extremists, it is a problem.
Okay, well, Michael Jones, I want to go back to your statements there. And please walk us through, if you can. And the first angle that I'd like to ask you on is your general statement where you said the U.S. is not white. I'm trying to understand why this label white now is being used in your eyes by the government, what the reasons are, the motives behind the government to look at it in the angle and lens that you are. I mean, if you can back that up for us a little bit here.
Yes, yes. The motive is political control. As soon as a group is white, they're bad because they're racist. So if they can get you to identify as white, you already lost. Charlottesville, classic example of what I'm talking about. So what is a white guy? Okay, there are people who identify as white. It's a Protestant, doesn't go to church anymore. Okay, and what I'm talking about now is the real theory of ethnicity. It's a word we have to bring up here. Ethnicity is the antithesis of race in this instance, okay? And there's a theory about American ethnicity, and it's called the triple melting pot, sociological theory, that says after the nations in America, your ethnicity is determined by your religion. That is what happened in St. Louis. So there are three ethnic groups in America. They're Protestant, Catholic, and Jew. That's your identity. That's your ethnic identity in America. That's what the oligarchs are trying to destroy. That's what I restored when I wrote the article about St. Louis. That's the real dynamic about what's going on here. Whether my colleague agrees with me or not, that's the story in America. It's ethnic. And I'm not white. I'm biracial. I'm Irish and I'm German. Now, these things are all being erased in a massive campaign of identity theft.
Well, this brings about the whole notion of going to waste, Jonathan Fryer, of multiculturalism, whether it's religious multiculturalism or any type that would fall under that umbrella, from, as I mentioned, religion to race to you name it. But we're having consequences of tensions which has amounted to violence and acts such as xenophobia. I mean, that's what happened in Europe. That forced the MEPs in the European Parliament to take firm action against neo-fascist, as they call the neo-Nazi groups. And maybe some people don't know what a neo-fascist group perhaps is. So hasn't the negative notions, what is at the heart of this problem, again, violence perhaps being one of the negative consequences?
Well, I think it's at the heart of the problem is the fact, as the Secretary General of the UN rightly pointed out, the fact that these groups are talking to each other, that Steve Bannon from the United States is in close contact with far-right groups here in Europe, and that European MEPs of different parties have realized that they have much in common, that Geert Wilders in the Netherlands or the new Vox Party and the Iberian Peninsula are meeting together and are discussing things together and realizing that they have common cause, which is to attack the white majority from a white supremacist point of view, so that they claim that the white majority is the establishment of Europe, but the white majority is not listening to the white minority, the white supremacists, who argue that not only is white right, white is best, and that therefore you should be better if you support the white people. And this is a narrative that appeals to certain people, particularly of little education, who have a lot of pressures on them at the moment, particularly during the pandemic. The unemployment rate has risen in Europe as it has in the United States, and not everybody receives the sort of help that is available from the government. And therefore, they are approving this sort of message that is coming across from a minority. It's a minority which has a voice and which is able, through social media these days, to communicate with each other as well as communicate with the general population.
Okay, my final question goes to you, E. Michael Jones. The statement that the U.S. Secretary General has made is in reference to the politicians who have this notion of white supremacy. How can, he said, I'm sorry, quote, we need global coordinated action to defeat this grave and growing danger. So what does he propose to do? I mean, what does he have as a game plan?
What he's got is a worldwide rebellion against the oligarchs. That's what's going on. India is part of this. The yellow vest, Brexit, Trump, all sorts of people are upset with oligarchic rule. These are not white supremacists. I'm trying to tell you, it's their category. If you collaborate by putting this label on people who are upset with the oligarchic rule, you're working for the oligarchs. It's a category of the mind. You should be able to see through this and see the political purpose behind it. If you can't, you're part of the problem.
Very well. We're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Very enlightening indeed. Let me thank our guest, editor of Culture Wars Online Magazine, Michael Jones, there with his statements, and author and broadcaster Jonathan Fryer. Pleasure. Talk to us from London. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From me, Kavitha, my entire team in the capital of Tehran. It's goodbye.